Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of October. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about what other countries in the world have done to revive their economies. I mentioned during the right before the news break that Paul Krugman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics this week, asked the question yesterday in his column, has Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, saved the world financial system? So that will be the theme or the question of this hour. The International Herald Tribune writes yesterday that the British government, in a remarkable departure from two decades of movement away from state ownership by both Labour and Conservative governments, said it would acquire controlling stakes in the Royal Bank of Scotland and the newly combined Bank of Lloyds, TSB, and HBOS in exchange for $64 billion capital infusion. There has been frenzied activity in the United States as well and in other countries in the world to rescue the financial system globally. And we'll be talking about what countries are doing this hour of our program and go to London for our guest this hour. Professor John Danielson is with us, Associate Professor of Finance at the London School of Economics. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Danielson. Our phone number, and I'm sure we'll have a lot of calls on this, you're all vitally concerned about the economy, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation today, or send an email if you'd like, and that number is talk@wpr.org. Before we begin, we do want to thank everyone who has supported Wisconsin Public Radio during our fall pledge drive. We had 6,300 people make contributions totaling more than $820,000, and we welcome 1,746 new members to the Wisconsin Public Radio Association. Thank you so much for all of your contributions to the work that we do every day so we can bring you these important discussions every day. And we go to Professor Don Daniel. Hello. Thank you, sir, so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you very much for having me.
The question that one of our lead economists who won the Nobel Prize yesterday, Paul Krugman, said in his column was, has Gordon Brown, the British Prime Minister, saved the world financial system? What do you say? Has he?
Well, the Gordon Brown would certainly like for that to be true.
I'm sure.
He is definitely having some serious problems here at home. I mean, he's trailing very badly behind in the polls. He's due for an election next year, and every indication is that he will definitely crash and burn in his entire party. So he's been desperate for any good headlines. So, I mean, but I think he just got lucky. That is, I think every country in the world was ready with something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably more like the weakness of the British banking system has meant that it had to happen here first. But it could have happened in Germany, France, United States, anywhere. And I'm sure if it had happened to the U.S., your government would have gotten credit for it in Germany, the German government, etc. So I think you got lucky.
Mm-hmm. He was also quoted as saying that it takes a crisis for people to agree that what is obvious and should have been done years ago can no longer be postponed. Should this have been done years ago?
It's always good to be wise afterwards, but we don't have hindsight, maybe.
Mm.
Nobody can really claim they foresaw what was happening. And people who claim they foresaw it, they are just making that up. Nobody could have predicted this. And everybody, the government was cheerleading this, the regulators, and the public who kept on buying property at inflated prices. I think we all participated in the party, and we are just now feeling we're now getting the hangover afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me, please, because I don't fully understand this, how interconnected the global financial system is now so that when we started experiencing trouble in the United States, it just spread to global financial markets all over the world?
Basically, the way it works is that if a company in Britain or the United States needs to borrow $1 million, where they get the money from, it might come from the next door, it might come from New York, it might come from London or Tokyo. Basically, their bank will find the best deal for them. And it's quite possible that somebody in London happens to have the excess dollars and is willing to provide the money. So people are borrowing and lending all around the world continually. So instead, in the old days, the banks used to be in one town, dealing with people in the town, later on maybe the state, maybe later on in the country. Now the whole world has become one big financial market, and it makes no difference if this institution next door to you or around the world.
Mm-hmm. And can we pinpoint a beginning of all of this? Was it the U.S. housing market? Was it the crisis here that started all of this?
That might be a common explanation. I think more common in the press in the United States than it is here. Banks and bankers do not need any help to get into trouble. What was behind this was the old combination of greed and stupidity. The housing market, the subprime market in the U.S., is worth maybe $500 billion, which is, for the global bond market, for the global sort of fixed income lending market, that's quite a small amount of money. And $500 billion is not big enough to get anybody into trouble. Maybe one or two institutions, but definitely not big enough to get the whole system or make the whole system crash. Mm-hmm. What really happened was the banks took these risky assets, and I do think subprime mortgages are good, in principle. The banks did take those risky assets. They packaged them together in a very complicated way in something called structured products. And they made them so complicated that their counterparties, the regulators, even themselves did not understand what they were doing. Now, when everything was doing fine, it made no difference. You made things complicated. You always found somebody to buy it because everything went up and it didn't matter what you were selling. Prices always went up. But in the end, somebody called the emperor has no clothes. There is nothing behind this. And the whole building came crashing down. It was really the banks just being too smart for their own good that caused this to happen.
Mm. And they took those assets because of greed? Because they could make a lot of money off them?
I mean, banks are in the business of making money like any other business. And the banks make money by taking products, repackaging them or doing something with them and selling them on. And what it did is that it just take a whole bunch of subprime mortgages, say. They put them into one deal and say, you can buy part of the payments from those mortgages. You pay me $1 million, you're the first guy to get paid. Somebody says, you pay me $800,000, you're the second guy to get paid. So that is how the structured products work. You take something coming in, mortgages, and you sell somebody else right to get the money coming out at the other end. Now, these things become enormously complicated. I mean, the example I just gave you is just a simple example, but they package together all types of mortgages from different towns, from different credit rating, maybe put some corporate bonds into it. Who knows what they put into the mix? Mm-hmm. And in the end, the mix became so complicated that they had no idea what they had in their hands.
Hmm. The market, as you well know, after this horrendous slide last week in the United States and around the world, just roared back yesterday. Can you tell me, is that a terrific sign? Is it a sign that the bottom has been reached here, or do we not know what's ahead?
I think it is signaling or signifying a few different things. There have been worries over the past few weeks and months, that the government might not be sufficiently determined or politically able to do what was necessary to deal with the crisis, whatever the crisis may be. And the worst thing that could happen is if you repeat the mistakes of 1929, with everybody looking out on themselves, government not providing the necessary thing for necessary packages. Because banking, if you don't have banks, you don't have economy. You need the banks no matter what. However, the government does have infinite amount of money if it wants to. The government creates money. The government of the United States and Great Britain and any big country, they have enough money to take over the entire banking system if they want to. Now, we don't want them to do it, but they can. If they do that, they take away all the uncertainty, all the problems, and everything would sort of function more or less okay. What the government has done, what it did last week, is to tell the world, we are stand ready to do what it takes. Here is a huge package. And if this package doesn't work, we'll do something more. And the markets are in a panic. It's all the uncertainty. Nobody trusts anybody else. But if the government says, guys, we are here, we'll do what it takes, that calms the markets. And the prices were sort of anticipating even a worse outcome, a worse crisis. And when the government got its act together, it calmed everybody and the market recovered, or started to recover.
Mm-hmm. And where is all this money coming from? Are governments just printing new money? Because we're also in a huge debt here in the United States. We're funding a very expensive war. I don't understand, and we have a government to run and programs and all of that. Where does this money come from for banks?
There are a couple of things in this. Now, of course, the government is not spending money. The government is investing the money. And I'm pretty sure, like in this British case and in some of the cases we are seeing in the United States, the government might make quite a lot of money in the end. But where the money is coming from is there is no shortage of money in the world. It's just the money doesn't want to go where the money where it's needed. So a lot of savings, pension funds, etc. And the yields on U.S. treasuries, on U.S. government debt, are very low. The United States government can borrow at extremely favorable rates at the moment. So, and there's a lot of people that want to lend to the U.S. government. So they have no money, no problem borrowing anything they want to do this. And in the worst case, they can print money, but at the moment, they have no problems borrowing.
And they're borrowing from China mostly, or where?
They're borrowing from China, from you and I, from everybody. I mean, the pension funds in the United States, your pension fund maybe, it's used to put money on the interbank market, used to put the money into banks. They are now preferring to buy treasuries by government debt. So it's people everywhere, pension funds, companies, individuals, municipalities, anybody who has excess cash. And a lot of entities have excess cash. In the old times, well, before the crisis, this money would have ended up on Wall Street maybe, but now it ends up in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk for a moment about the people who don't have excess cash. And you mentioned the housing in England, and certainly the housing in the United States, where people are unable to pay their mortgages, they're losing their homes, the unemployment rate is going up. What about the average person in both countries here or in the world who doesn't have that excess cash and is hurting right now, and people who are worried about their pensions and they've lost a lot of money in the last few weeks? Do these worldwide plans help the average person who's really going through a hard time?
It doesn't look like, it may not look like it is helping or will help the ordinary person, but it does help, because if things get worse, everybody gets hurt. And those who get hurt first are those with the least amount of money. So what we really don't, things are bad at the moment, and things are a lot worse in the United States than elsewhere for a lot of people at the moment. But if things get worse, it is the people with the least amount of money, with the least job security, who are first to be hurt. And therefore, it is important that the government gets the financial house in order so that recovery can start.
And how long will recovery take, do you think, Professor Danielson?
If I could forecast, I'd be a rich man today. I have absolutely no idea. It could happen as early as this year, or it could take 5 years. I mean, there is no way. And anybody telling you that they have an idea, I think they're just making that up.
Let's welcome phone calls. Joining us by phone today from London is Professor John Danielson. He's an associate professor of finance at the London School of Economics, and we're welcoming phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation, or send an email if you'd like. The email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org, for you to join this conversation about what's going on in the world to deal with the economic crisis. Our phone lines are all open right now, so grab one. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, Michael Pollan will be joining us, author of a piece in the New York Times Magazine section last Sunday, Farmer in Chief, What the Next President Can and Should Do to Remake the Way That We Grow and Eat Our Food. Professor John Danielson is with us now, Associate Professor of Finance at the London School of Economics. We're looking at what various countries in the world have done to ease the financial crisis that's affecting the whole globe. And going to London for our interview with him. Of course, England has taken some profound steps here. The United States is now investing $250 billion to bolster the bank industry in this country, and various steps are being taken all over the world. So we're welcoming your thoughts and your questions about this as well. Our number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or you can use an email, and that's talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. Can we go back to housing for just one moment here, Professor Danielson, which has been a problem here in the United States with the subprime mortgages? I was noticing we went to our family to Ireland this past summer, and it was an incredibly expensive trip for us. But the one thing that really struck me was the number of new houses that were being constructed all over the country. It was hard to find in Ireland that I remembered from even 1989. And I'm sure that that's going on in other parts of Europe as well. There just was an amazing housing boom going on. What is happening to all of the people who have built these new houses or they're under construction right now? Are they experiencing severe problems right now?
Ireland has been quite a fortunate country in the past, say, 10, 20 years. One reason is they came into the, joined the European Union some years back, and European, because they used to be a very poor region of Europe, they got very large subsidies from the rest of Europe. So a lot of money has been coming in from the taxpayers of the other European countries to help the Irish. And they, fortunately, unlike some other European countries, they put that money to good use, and they used the money they got from Europe to build up the economy. And Ireland started from a very low base. They used to be very poor, say, 25 years ago, and when a country that is very poor gets act together, gets money, they are able to grow quite fast, at least for some years. And the Irish have been growing faster than almost anybody else in Europe for the past 20 years, and that, of course, explains all the new housing. And now that they've become so rich, of course, things are slowing down. But I don't think Ireland is not really having any serious problems in their housing, unlike some other European countries.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to some phone calls, starting with Daryl from Exonia. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. Well, I have a comment to make about, like, when you asked the guy, well, how does that affect the average poor person? And he said, well, basically, if it hurts at the top, it's going to hurt more at the bottom. And isn't that the kind of thinking that got us into this mess where they said, oh, if we help everyone on top prosper, it'll all trickle down to the rest of us? I mean, nobody's bailing me out of anything. If I wanted to start a business, where's the government saying, oh, the economy's bad, well, we'll give this guy some money, he may start a business. You know, you say, oh, no, we got to give the rich people money because it might trickle down to the rest of us. Well, that's the kind of thinking that got us into this mess.
No, I disagree with that. This is nothing to do with the trickle-down type economics which some people have advocated. It really means the following. If you are a business and you don't have access to banking services, you will fail. You need, as a business, to have a checking account. You need to have a bank account. You need to be able to borrow. You need to be able to sell on, get trade credit, et cetera, et cetera. Without banking services, there is no economy. And what the government is saying is we need to have a banking system no matter what. They are not providing this money for rich bankers. Indeed, I mean, people on Wall Street have lost enormous amounts of money. They have the both salaries and bonuses will be going down. The stock price is down in the toilet, et cetera. But what they're saying is, at the moment, what is the most important task of the government is to have banking services continue uninterrupted no matter what. Because in the Great Depression, really, one of the biggest problems was that entire states lost the entire banking system. All of a sudden, you woke up, there are no banks. And therefore, of course, everything crashed right afterwards. That's what they're doing. These are desperate measures, but these are desperate times.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Matt from Lake Geneva next. Hi, Matt.
Oh, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering about the root cause, which I think is monetary policy. Somewhere along the way, you know, after the New Deal and the Great Depression, we moved from a system where you had to have savings, which is a logical system, where you have to have savings before you can have investment and before you can have money to spend. You got to save it first. But somewhere along the way, Keynesian economists decided that governments could just print money out of thin air and we wouldn't need to rely on savings. And there's a real, I think, corrupting effect in all of that because, you know, it's like a moral hazard. You know, you don't need discipline anymore. You don't need to save. And governments become the saviors because they have printing presses that can create money out of thin air. And then it seems the banking system, you know, flourishes under that because of the fractional reserve banking laws, which allow banks basically to make money without money. You know, these are like licenses to prosper that are granted by the government. And it seems like much more so than the limited amount of greed having to do with the recent affairs of in the housing markets and so forth, it's this root cause is this monetary policy, you know, fanciful policy that says we don't need to have savings. The government can just print the money.
Professor Danielson.
Of course, there is nothing new about government behaving like this. Governments have been printing money and defaulting since the beginning of history, and they will probably continue doing so until the end of time. But I do agree with a lot of what you said. What the government has done with monetary policy, government has been quite irresponsible at times. There is this concept known to economists, what's called the Greenspan put, named after Alan Greenspan. A Greenspan put says, when the financial markets get into trouble, the U.S. government steps in and floods the system with cash. They've done that on a few occasions in the past. Basically, the saying is, there are some problems with liquidity. Don't worry, guys. We'll come in, we'll put cash into the system, and we'll lower interest rates. And that, of course, is a big source of the problem, is that the government did come in and provide cash every time there was a hiccup, and that just encourages the banking system, the bankers, to behave even more behave more irresponsibly. But this is related to a second problem. Interest rates have been too low. So if you take the pension funds, who are the biggest savers in the world, the pension funds need to get a certain percentage income to be able to meet their obligations. If they can't do that, if they can't earn the right percentage, they have to put their money onto Wall Street, where the risk is. Interest rates have been too low. It says nothing, and that is also causing the problem. So the monetary policy clearly is a factor in what's going on.
Is this just symbolic? But if so, is it important symbolism? I know part of the British plan was some of the top executives of banks were told to resign. Is that a big thing?
No, it's just politics. It's symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean the. Economically, I don't think it makes any difference whatsoever. Now, there is a desire. There is a lot of, one big problem in the past, in the recent years, is that the income distributions have become more and more skewed. What that means is that there's an ever-increasing number of people who seem to be almost infinitely rich. And a lot of these people are based on Wall Street and there's envy, and that creates problems and frictions in society. So there's a lot of political pressure to do something about those people earning those enormous salaries. In normal times, the government cannot do anything about it, but it is understandable and clear that if the government is coming in and rescuing the banks and rescuing the banking system, that the government say at the same time, we have this political goal, we don't like these high salaries, you guys better do something about it. But it is politics and not really economics.
Mm-hmm. Is there a difference between the American plans and the British plans to check the salaries of some of these? This may not be a big deal, but I think symbolically it is a big deal in this country. To check the salaries of some of these people, to hold the salaries at a certain level?
I think there is, it is more difficult politically and more difficult within the system you have in the United States to do that than in Europe. You do have, and this is something I admire greatly, you do have this spirit of you take your risk, you get the reward, you fail. And this is something which is often lacking here in Europe. And therefore, there's more sense that if you make high salaries, you are entitled to them because you were good. While in Europe, the politics often says this is corruption or whatever bad thing. And therefore, politically in the U.S., it's a lot harder, I think, for the government to do something about high salaries than in Europe. And that shows why Gordon Brown could do what he did. And I think the U.S. government would find it a lot more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Matt, very much for your call. Let's go to Samir from Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question.
Go right ahead.
If we are printing out $700 billion and putting those in the system without covering with the same amount of equivalent of product or gold, we have an increase of the supply of the money, and now maybe the prices are going to go high. And the people who are going to buy those products, they are going to pay with money they have to earn producing something, and they are going to pay for those money. This is my question.
The government has two different ways of paying for this. The government can print money, as somebody also suggested earlier, and that is your comment, or the government can borrow the money. I think the government is not printing the money and therefore putting these forces into effect like you discussed. I think the government is borrowing the money, and therefore they are just taking the money from the system and putting it right back in. There will be no change on the prices or these effects you discussed.
Thanks for the call. We have an email. Some economists and financial analysts argue that the $700 billion amount here in this country should be given directly to the people, possibly a lot of money, which in turn would be an immediate economic stimulus because some people would use it to repay or refinance their mortgage, helping the housing market. Some would invest it driving up stocks. Some would deposit in banks, increasing their capital, and some would spend it, increasing demand and helping the economy. Wouldn't this be a faster, more direct way out of this crisis, this one directed to the United States, but I imagine applicable in England as well?
The short answer is no. And I'll give you the longer answer also.
Okay.
What you're saying is what is sort of called a stimulus package, something that stimulates the economy, encourages economic activities, and can be a good thing or a bad thing. That's just a political question and a longer-run economic question. However, this would do nothing to solve the problem we are facing right now. The problem we are facing right now is that banks are unwilling to behave as banks. But you can almost put it this way. The banks have gone on strike. They borrow from the Fed at 5% and deposit the money at the Fed at 2%, losing 3%. The numbers are, these are not exact numbers, but this is close to what the real numbers are. The banks are not lending, and the only way out of the crisis is for banks to continue lending, and for that they need to trust each other, trust that they will not default on assets they don't understand. And really the only way to do that is to flood the banking system with money and unfortunately for the government even to put direct cash into the banks. Your suggestion is it can be very good for the general economy but would not help solve this current crisis.
We go to Joe from Milwaukee next. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. My question, and by the way, I thought you gave a really great explanation of the genesis of the crisis, but in terms of the chain of responsibility for how this all came about, it seems to me that it's the ratings agencies and the insurers who, when presented with a security that is so murky that they couldn't figure it out, and that it honestly appears to only work when the housing market's going up, or in any case, whatever was the reason, they just didn't understand it, yet they gave it a AAA rating. And then everybody else acted accordingly. And then, and likewise, the insurers, you know, looked at these bonds and said, "Oh yes, absolutely, we will insure them for you know X number of dollars." And when it actually came time to pay on their horrific mistake, they just folded like a house of cards. So my question is, how does such a thing occur? I heard an interview on MSNBC by Dylan Radigan of one of the people from Moody's who was charged with, you know, doing this, who gave these bonds AAA ratings and turned around and is now giving them junk ratings. And the guy was asking them, how is it possible that you didn't know the value of them then and gave them AAA, and you don't know the value of them now and are giving them junk. So that's my question.
Thanks for the call, Joe.
I could not agree more with what you said. Indeed, I wrote a paper recently called Blame the Models. This exactly made very similar points to what you did. The rating agencies, they have behaved abominably. The rating agencies are the entities. They are like the policemen of the system. They are the guards because their function is bank create some security. They sell it on to the public. The rating agencies come in and say, this is a good, bad, or ugly security. And you trust them to give you an accurate, reasonable judgment. Indeed, there's an interesting article in the New York Times magazine about exactly this some not too long ago, how badly they judged it. They made profits out of giving ratings. The more ratings they gave, the more profit they make. And they spend 1 day, 2 days maybe, giving the ratings, and the more they got, the more profit they made. And really, the only reason why the banks would come to them is if they got a AAA rating. So their business model was based on churning these things out as quickly as possible at the highest possible rating and without really seeming to do any due diligence or seeming to sort of understand or try to understand really the risk of what they were doing. I think they behaved absolutely, if not criminally, they absolutely failed the agencies here.
Professor Danielson, I assume that you either are from Iceland or you've spent some time there, because there aren't too many people in the world who are fluent, both written and spoken in Icelandic. So let me ask you this, assuming that you will have an understanding of what in the world is going on in Iceland, whose system, at least net last week's news reports, were saying the financial system was totally broken.
Now, I think we've almost for the first time in my life, I say I'm almost ashamed of being from Iceland.
You are from Iceland.
Yeah, I am indeed. And I've always been very proud of being from there. And in the 10 years I lived in the United States, I was always very happy to say I'm from Iceland. At the moment, especially here in Britain, because the press is so badly, the press is so negative, there are so many attacks on Iceland here in Britain for reasons we can get into, is that I'm almost feeling ashamed. Not quite. What happened is maybe two or three things. At the moment, in Iceland, imagine your car loans or your mortgage had doubled. Mm. Imagine the price of food had gone up 50%.
Mm.
Imagine your salary was frozen. Imagine all of your savings got wiped out, and you were most likely to lose your job. That happened in like a couple of weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
And at no time in history has a country crashed as badly and as quickly as Iceland. It has gone from being one of the richest places in the world to be extremely poor with enormous problems. And I'm reading in the newspaper this morning that you might have difficulty getting food because you need to import food and you can't get foreign currency to import it. And they're worried about access to medicine. I mean, for a rich country, that is completely unprecedented.
Why did it hit so hard in Iceland?
It is a couple of things. The Icelanders, of course, are to blame for the mess they got themselves into. What it did is basically two things, sort of historically. One, they had a monetary policy which encouraged and wanted high interest rates. When you have high interest rates, you have a choice to borrow for your car loan in U.S. dollars or Icelandic krona. And they could borrow and make you could get a mortgage in the U.S. for 6% or pay 16% in Iceland. You could get a mortgage in euros for 4% or yen for 2%. So people faced with that. Instead of borrowing money in Iceland, they borrowed money abroad in foreign currency. Also, foreign speculators saw the high interest rates. They borrow in Japan at 1% and put the money into a bank in Iceland at 16, earning huge profits. The country was flooded with money, with foreign cash. And at the end, the exchange rate was completely out of any proportion with the underlying economy. It was a bubble that had to burst. I mean, I made the case repeatedly. Guys, this will happen. And I was laughed at the time. At the same time, they built a banking system that is 10 times the size of the economy.
Mm.
So imagine in the U.S., it's roughly the same size as the economy. It's 10 times. And at the moment, any bank without a strong government behind it will fail. So what happened was, when this crisis hit globally, Iceland was really the first victim of the crisis because the government was too small to be able to support the banking system. And I think in my mind is what happened there should be a warning sign to the rest of the world that what can happen if this crisis is not dealt with properly.
And what will happen to Iceland now?
Well, I mean, at the moment, I have relatives crying on the phone with me. I can tell you a story. I have an 8-year-old niece in Iceland who is just beginning to write. And to practice her spelling, she likes to send Uncle John emails. So we just talk about things by email. And of course, her spelling is bad, but she's learning. And I got an email from her last week says, Uncle John, is it really true the crisis is so bad that they will no longer send out the cartoons?
Oh, my.
And that almost made me cry. I mean, oh. But that tells me how bad it is. However, because it is so small, it can react very quickly. So they can react in a way that you could not do in the United Kingdom or the United States. And they are reacting very quickly to turn it around. They can go to the International Monetary Fund and say, guys, help us out. And they would help. They are looking at, and they would help them out. So I think in the medium to long run, they will get out of it. But at the moment, the situation is beyond terrible. I mean, it's unimaginable.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Professor John Danielson, joining us by phone from London. He's Associate Professor of Finance at the London School of Economics. Our phone number and a couple lines are open here right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, the email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about the global financial market as some remarkable things are happening both here in the United States and perhaps started in England. In the United States, the government has planned to put $250 billion into the banking system, small banks and large banks, which is something that is a huge government move in this country into the nation's financial markets, which reports are saying today has not happened since the Great Depression and perhaps has never happened, according to some economists and finance experts. Of course, in England, there have been moves also to put money into nationalize some of the banks in England, and we're looking at these remarkable moves taking place in various parts of the world and what the immediate response has been on financial markets all over the world and what the long-term response may be, which I guess nobody knows. To more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program this Tuesday, Michael Pollan will be joining us. What an interesting guy he is, and he has some calls to the new president, whoever he may be, in the new magazine New York Times last Sunday, actually. Farmer-in-Chief, what the next president can and should do to remake the way we grow and eat food. That's coming up, hour number two. Our guest this hour, by phone from London, John Danielson, Associate Professor of Finance at the London School of Economics. And he also, I don't know too many people from Iceland, but as you heard him describe the horrible circumstances in Iceland the past month, really, he's from Iceland and has a deep understanding of what's going on there as well. Tom from Burlington, hello.
I think they're, from what I heard, they're going to be helping Iceland with a loan from England for, I think it's $6 billion. I'm not exactly sure. But a month ago, you and I, Kathleen, were on the telephone, and I suggested that we had to bail out the banks and the borrowers as well to keep confidence. And a month later, we've lost $3 trillion. The amazing thing about this crisis is that 19 months ago, we started losing, there were 1 million foreclosures and dumping. They foreclose on the house and dump it on the housing market. And this pushes the price of all the other houses down, which creates the collateral that is no collateral. And our leaders, Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain and Mr. Biden, were in the Senate, and they did absolutely nothing to look at this problem and solve it before it really got very, very bad. But the question I want to put out is this. On our commodity markets, we have a thing called limit up and limit down. In other words, in wheat and corn, if the price goes a certain, falls a certain price or goes up a certain price, they stop the trading in that. And I suggest, and I want your guest there put out this idea that maybe we should do that in our markets, in our stock markets around the world, that everybody does this to prevent these wild swings in prices. We need something to slow it down and get back the calmness and the confidence in this thing.
Professor Danielson.
Indeed, the very same thing was proposed by the Prime Minister of Italy, Berlusconi, a couple of weeks ago, and he was very quick to retract that proposal. I think closing down of markets when the markets become too volatile doesn't really work, because it just sends the signal that something's wrong and things just build up. However, in this particular case, I think this would definitely not work, and I'll explain why. The crisis is not a crisis in the stock market. The stock market is only sort of a victim of this. The crisis is really the fact that banks are not lending to anybody. And the fact they're not lending, that means there's no trading, there is no action going on in the markets. So whether or not the stock markets move up and down has no bearings on the bank's desire to or ability to lend and borrow. And what they really need to get started is to get the banks to behave as banks and just not sit on their behinds and do nothing.
Thanks, Tom, very much for the call. Let's go to an email. It's good that you're looking at the present financial mess from an educated British perspective. I'm not surprised that British Prime Minister Gordon Brown led the rescue with a viable plan, because the British have a steely resolve with a common sense approach to solving problems. By contrast, President Bush and the fat American cats appeared to be out of their league. The clueless Bush was giving speech after speech about the crisis and wasn't saying anything meaningful, hence the markets were going down. Whatever happened to Yankee ingenuity?
I wish this was true. I really, really wish that England was led by somebody who was that good. And sadly, I don't believe that. I mean, I think everybody failed. Gordon Brown is no better than anybody else. I mean, I don't want to get into any direct comparison with the political situation in the United States, but Gordon Brown, he failed on the votes, and everybody failed on the votes. I think he's just lucky with the press he's getting this week, and trust me, he is desperate for good press. Hmm.
And what about, you can make a comment about the way it's been handled in the United States. Feel perfectly free to do so if you'd like.
No, I just did not want to get into the political side
right.
of the United States.
Right.
That's all I really meant.
Yeah, but it's interesting to me that the whole policy, and tell me why this happened, that, you know, last week or the week before, this is all happening so rapidly, the $700 billion bailout was not what it appears to be today, where today we're getting news that $250 billion of that $700 billion in the United States will be going directly to prop up large and small banks in this country. Are we taking a lead from the British on this? Did you guys come up with this, and Brown in particular come up with this, and we thought in the United States, oh yeah, that we need to do that as well?
If you had looked at the headlines 3 weeks ago, the headlines said the United States is leading the world in reacting to the crisis. The headlines today say that Britain is leading. Mm-hmm. Headlines tomorrow will say Japan, Germany, who knows, mm-hmm. is leading the crisis. This is just today's news. I think, and I looked at this $700 billion package in the U.S., and I was struck by how ambitious, how powerful it was. I was really impressed, and I can tell you one thing that you can be extremely fortunate off in the United States, and something of this we had anywhere else in the world. The person in charge of the Federal Reserve System, Bernie Bernanke, he is the best equipped person to do this. He is a student. He built his academic career on studying the mistakes of the Great Depression. He knows what was done wrong then. And I can see his fingerprints on the whole thing. So you do have a guy in charge of the system, guy who knows exactly what's going on, knows exactly what should be done, and you were extremely fortunate in that. And I think more often than not, the U.S. government or the U.S. system has taken a lead in dealing with this, and I was very impressed with the $700 billion package when it came out.
Kathy from Greendale is next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to start with this. I totally disagree with the remark that you made, Professor Danielson, earlier in the program about the banks could not have foreseen this. They could not have been aware of this happening. And I have to say that that's just not possible. These folks knew exactly what they were doing. Someone has made enormous amounts of money off of this. As you said, there's still a lot of money in this system. We need to find out in whose hands it is exactly, because that's the issue. Someone has made enormous amounts of money from this whole thing, and they stand to make more money by all of this bailout stuff. This is another robbery of the Treasury, and until people acknowledge that, nothing is going to change. It has to happen. Back in 1995, I bought a DVD by Noam Chomsky. He was talking about labor. But one of the things he said, which I realize now is very insightful, is on the MIT campuses, he said he was noticing that the recruiters that were coming onto campus from corporations and from banks were no longer looking for people in business. They were looking for mathematicians. And this is what it has all wrought. All the brilliant mathematicians who could figure out how to scam the system even better than they knew how to do it before. The bankers are not naive. They know what's happening. One of our issues in this country, and I don't know about other countries, but we need to talk about the Federal Reserve, which is not part of the government, no matter what anyone wants to believe. It's the most you can say about it is that it's quasi-government, which means it just gives the appearance. It's a consortium of private banks, the same banks, if you look it up on the Internet, who are now getting money from the bailout, the exact same lineup of banks. I will close with a quote from Thomas Jefferson. They knew way back then, and they warned of this. It is, if the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, and he was realizing that that's exactly who controls this, the banks. He said, the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. The issuing power should be taken from the banks and restored to the people to whom it properly belongs.
Thank you, Kathy, very much for your call. Professor Danielson.
Now, I like the quote you gave at the end very much. And indeed, from the time that quote was written, it took 100 years for the United States to do exactly that. When they established the Federal Reserve System, what, 1912 or around that time, that's exactly when the power to create money went back to the government and where it should be. Now, to get back to your previous point, and you mentioned Noam Chomsky, and by pure chance, a couple of weeks ago, I was on a debate with him on the BBC website.
Oh, really?
Yes, exactly. And obviously, we came to completely opposite. We came to completely opposite views. But that's fine. He's a fine man, and he's a very good brain. And I'm very happy to disagree with him. But I was honored to be on the same webpage. I think if we can attribute this to stupidity rather than conspiracy, it is really stupidity, because everybody was looking at their own small part of the world. Everybody says, I am doing this thing, and not really properly understanding that if everybody else does the same thing, the whole system becomes unstable. And the entity responsible who was supposed to understand the whole system or where the risk is not really the banks themselves. And the banks were greedy and stupid. The entity that is charged with this is the regulator, the Fed, the SEC, and those guys. They are the guys who are supposed to have an overview, because they have the private information from the banks. They can talk to everybody. They are supposed to have the overview. And the purpose, I think one of your governors of the Federal Reserve System, he said, this is going back some decades, and he made a beautiful statement saying, the purpose of a central bank is to pull the plug on the party when the party is going the strongest. And the government did fail in that function. But your statement about the mathematicians and the Noam Chomsky's observation is exactly correct. However, it's not because they were corrupt. It's because the danger was you put the rocket scientists in charge of the financial system, the rocket scientists understand how to solve mathematical equations, how to run computer models. They don't understand finance. They don't understand economics. Their bosses, people above them in the banks, they understand finance, but they don't understand these complicated models that the rocket scientists created. And those two entities, they couldn't really communicate. So the rocket scientists, they created all these stupid products, all these complicated products that the people in charge of the system didn't understand. I would much rather attribute this to greed and stupidity rather than any global conspiracy of any type.
Thank you, Professor Danielson, so much. It was a really interesting hour. Thank you. Professor John Danielson, Associate Professor of Finance at the London School of Economics. Thanks for your calls. We were jammed with them. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of you, but rest assured we'll be on this topic again. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, and thanks for your calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.